Media shouldn't be one note. Support Rabble.ca and a diversity of voices in Canadian media. Visit rabble.ca/donate to contribute.
Welcome. You're listening to The Green Majority, broadcasting live right now out of CIUT 89.5 FM, or you could possibly be listening on one of our very appreciated community radio partners all the way across the country, now into the United States as well, or one of our international podcast listeners. Those listeners also get benefit of a bonus show, and today, for once, I actually have the bonus show planned. We're going to be talking about journalism, but I'll tease that more a little bit later in the show. Coming up in the middle of the show, in between two squished news sections like the creamy filling in an Oreo cookie.
Gotta love that.
Yeah, I'm hungry. I just do. is an interview actually that I'm happy to say reached out to us, and I'm happy to say that because it's cool that people know we exist.
Yeah.
So we were
just generally speaking.
Yeah, that's always fun. So we were actually contacted and asked would we like to interview Dr. Hugh Seeley, and I gave an emphatic yes, a very enthusiastic yes, because we're winning.
Yes.
With that strategy. He's the lead negotiator, or was the lead negotiator, for small island states. So these are countries that are most at risk from sea level rise and catastrophic weather patterns. And he was recently participating in COP20 in Morocco. He is going to be speaking to us today. We didn't actually plan out a specific topic aside from the fact that it would just be really interesting to talk to him. But I feel like all of the oxygen has been sucked out of the room, and we're probably going to have to talk about Trump whether we wanted to or not. I am, however, going to give Dr. Seeley a chance to talk about something else he would like, and we will hear from him in the middle of the program. Later on in the program, I'm going to be covering more of a national focus. We're going to talk a little bit about KXL. We're going to talk about Trump re Notley and Trudeau. There was also some oil spills and some other fantastic news as well going along with that. So we'll leave that for later.
Such fantastic news.
Do I have to say that I'm just assume that I'm being sarcastic at this point?
That's a good point.
I should probably point that out in case this is a first time listener.
Yeah,
incredibly sarcastic on this show.
I would really appreciate if someone got on the show and was like, these people are pro oil spills. All right, that's an interesting take. It's a hot take, Darren.
Yeah.
Well, sure that every single show had an oil spill happen.
There's always oil spills everywhere. That is true.
So with that though, let's not suck. Speaking of sucking oxygen out of the room, let me not suck Stefan's oxygen out of the room. And would you please take it away with our international focus, Stefan?
Sure thing. By international focus, as far and wide as that goes this week, it's pretty Trump focused. And by that, I mean entirely Trump-focused, so I hope we're all okay with that. Mainly because this is the first of a likely 208-part series called Resisting Trump. Now, of course, that presumes he doesn't get impeached, which is, I think, at this point, probably a toss-up, to be honest. What I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to give a quick rundown of the things he's done this week, because one of the suggestions we received last week of ways to successfully resist Trump was actually to create a list and to write down and to note all of the things that have happened so in future we remember what is going on. So this is where we're at now. So this is after week one. This is where we've gotten, at least from the environmental standpoint. I have a little bit of other news, but it's mostly the environment because obviously the show. So first thing he did was freeze all regulations, which basically means that if you want to have a new regulation come in, you must you must find some way to convince the Trump brand, either someone who works directly for him or appointed by him, or the president himself, that your regulation is necessary. So that doesn't mean that they won't keep enforcing the current ones, but that no new regulations can come in. Even again, it's not fully clear because again, it's one of those things where executive orders are interesting because like they're being reported as if things have actually happened when it's more like it's sort of more similar to like sometimes president orders can have direct impacts, but more often not, they're telling another part of the government to do something. And at this point, Trump is telling a lot of parts of government which don't actually have anyone leading them because he hasn't appointed half the government right now.
And two and a half years ago, Steph and I did a very recently after we met, I did a we were at a conference and I did a little workshop called How to Read the News. I feel like we're going to have to reinvent that. So I don't know that this is the official or ongoing definition, but I feel like today's 2017 definitions have to be established, which is that a journalist is someone who investigates things and verifies facts and looks up for other angles and fully explores the story, something we aspire to be here on this program. A reporter going forward is someone who literally just regurgitates what somebody says. And so I want people to go out there, no matter where you're reading from, if the only lines in the article are Trump administration says this, Trudeau administration says that, whatever, so-and-so says this, and it's just a bunch of says, you have to have the immediate instinct, regardless of what the outcome is, that you are not getting the whole story. That doesn't mean they're lying. That doesn't mean this. That doesn't mean anything. But just understand that you are not getting the whole story if that's the entire content of the article.
Well, and I think to jump off on that as well, I think there has to be a distinction, and it's very difficult to make this distinction because we don't all have the time. Like we all have lives that exist outside of trying to pay attention to this. The difference between Trump has said something and Trump is doing something. Because those are wildly different half the time. And then often it's he'll do something, which then gets even more confusing. There's like three or four things that when doing the press story, I had heard about, and then I had to sort of do further research to figure out has he actually done this? What does this actually mean? He froze all federal hiring, but then again, I was like, okay, that's interesting. But then three pretty high up in security department all left at the same time yesterday en masse. As like a protest, basically, and I was like, "Does that mean they can't fill those?" Because he's high, and like, there's so much nuance in each one of these things, especially as he is saying different things, that it is you definitely want to discern what he has said from what he has done, and I would recommend only paying attention to what he's done.
Yeah. And usually the problem with politicians is that, you know, the average member of the public doesn't understand the nuance. And so the politician who does, because they're career politicians, uses that misunderstanding to frequently, you know, misinform people. I mean, nothing is more obvious on that than the Obamacare, right? We have to cancel Obamacare. Wait, we're actually going to do it. Oh, maybe that's actually a really bad idea.
Yeah.
But the problem is that Trump also doesn't know, and he's in charge. That's a major difference. In case anyone's just saying, well, this is just new administration, you know, you don't like him, blah, 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 the losing side always gets upset. Mm-hmm. No, person is a maniac.
Well, and what's also funny, but this is a shout out to the preceding show to us, Democracy Now. There was a very short clip on this from a couple weeks ago, but it might even been early this week, where Trump was pointing out Rex Tillerson in the crowd. And the way he described Rex Tillerson to this crowd was that Tillerson went into countries, took all their oil, and then left to another country. And then it was like, way to go, and started applauding him. And you're like, yes, I agree with you that that's what he does. My reaction to doing that is just the opposite reaction than you're currently having. And then the idea that that's the guy who should be running our Secretary of State. Anyways, those things he said, not things he done. More things he actually did. Another executive order encouraged KXL and Nakota's access pipeline to be built. Now, again, this actually hasn't done anything yet. You can encourage them both to be built, but TransCanada would still need to actually resubmit their application, and for KXL, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers still has to finish their review of the Dakota Access Pipeline. So basically, he was like, these things should happen, and if they review, I want the Secretary of State, the State Department, to decide in 60 days. So basically, he's like, if you do the things, I want this to happen as fast as possible, but nothing started moving yet. He also, and I love this term, quote unquote, expedites environmental reviews, which basically means he's given a directive that all large infrastructure projects should have, worse and faster environmental reviews. Again, nothing has actually happened because they have to rewrite these laws, but this is another directive that he has put out. As a part of his instituting his federal hiring freeze, he also demanded 5,000 new border officials be hired and 10,000 new immigration officials be hired. So this is one of those things where he's sort of like being, look, small government, except for the security, which is, terrifying. And this one I added, actually, this is the last one of the quick notes, because there's more, but I'm just sort of going around with highlights. I added this one not because it's necessarily directly related to the environment, but because it was one of those very small things. And I think you can sort of see the – I think when you try to understand a big government like this, it's often in the minutia where they tip their hand a little bit or where end up being examples of where they're going. And so one thing he ordered to happen was he wanted to create a list updated weekly of crimes committed by undocumented immigrants in sanctuary jurisdictions, which basically he plans on you like this clearly sets out an agenda to massively attack immigrants. And a couple of his other moves and his state moves, his planned moves, would further those sort of difficulties. You know, he made a list of countries in which that he wants to like to temporarily freeze immigration from, temporary quote unquote, which were, you know, predominantly Muslim countries. And this is, I think, all of this together, I think, sort of gives you a decent sense of where this administration is heading. And again, what's interesting about this is that it's every single place he said he was going to do. This is not a situation of someone coming in saying they're going to be all nice and fuzzy and then doing these things. This is him coming in and saying, I am going to be a fascist, and then just doing it. And yeah, Everyone's like, oh, how did that happen?
Well, and that's really important because, I mean, I spent quite a bit of time during the election watching interviews. A lot of independent journalists were doing. None of the mainstream journalists were doing. They were too busy talking about stupid tweets. But actual journalists were going down and actually interviewing Trump supporters. And many of them do support these sorts of fascist things. So, I mean, that's the thing. But Trump supporters are not all one flavor, no, right? They come in a variety of flavors. And many of them were like, well, you know, I want the job stuff. And I really, you know, there are people that potentially would have voted for Hillary Clinton. Many of them said they absolutely would have preferred Bernie Sanders to both. But what's really important is they say, look, we don't really believe he's going to do any of that stuff. Like, he's just blowing, you know, hot air. But no, he's doing it.
Yeah, and he's doing it immediately.
Yeah,
yeah. And I think that's the piece that I want to get to, which is this piece of all of his moves, or almost all of his moves right now, have been working to consolidate. Will work to consolidate power. And further increase inequality, and I think these two pieces of and everything he's done so far is leading to that, right? He's trying to even some of the stuff he's written on the actual website, which you can go and read about the people he's trying to protect and not the people. Like he has piece about he doesn't actually think protesters deserve protections. He actually wants to protect the mom going out on a Sunday. Like it's so transparent the world he is trying to set up. In the America he's trying to set up.
Well, federal felony charges got laid against journalists.
Yes, six journalists
covering the protest. Journalists who were covering the protest in no way, and no one's even claiming that they were part of them. They're just felony charges.
Yeah, exactly. And this is all of this is part of intimidation process to ensure that, you know, that protests won't get covered well, and that as these things grow, these are the other pieces that we're going to start seeing.
This is a great time to further promote, though, that the bonus show topic is covering an article called "Dear Media, what Trump White House has total contempt for you. Time to react accordingly." That is the article we'll be talking about in the bonus show.
And that is, and he's already shown that, just unquestionably already shown that. We pointed out that we just got tweeted at by a regular contributor about how Trump's most recent federal disclosure forms filed in May show that he owns 15,000 to 50,000 in stock of the Texas-based Energy Transfer Partners, which is one of the organizations behind DAPL, which is a thing that I think it's at this point, every one of Trump's conflicts of interests are just – he's so many of them that – I think it's an Onion joke about how there were so many of them that he couldn't just pick one, and so he'd have to be fair. he's like, well, he's got so many conflicts of interest. What can he do? But to get to the final point of this entire sort of – A, it's just important to note what's happening and where we stand in the world right now. But B, as a bit of a call out, I think if there's anything that I've been sort of experiencing over the past little while, trying to figure out what the resistance to Trump looks like. I think that's the question everyone is asking themselves. And I think the first thing that we have to understand is everyone has to stand up for everyone else's issues. You know, if you're an environmentalist and you aren't going to the, you know, to the immigration reform the protests, or if you're not going to, you know, if you're not standing up as an environmentalist for your Muslim brothers and sisters, or for, you know, the workers' rights clampdown, or for journalists, or for scientists, or anything like that, you are being an ineffectual environmentalist. There's not going to be – the environmentalists are not going to fight this battle and win this battle by themselves. And if you refuse to be – you know, intersectional is usually used in a term of within people. But I think if your issue intersectionality is going to be as important, if not more important, in this fight. Because, you know, 55% of the American population can maybe stop something. But if you only show up for your own issue, you're going to be washed out. Because if he can divide each one of you, he can win.
And also when it comes to environmentalism and all of these other issues, they're so interlinked that if you are an environmentalist, then you probably support in one way or another all of those other causes, like science, for example.
Yeah.
Like you need science-based things to have so that you can have a voice as an environmentalist.
And I think
should also point out the disembodied voice, because we didn't introduce her because she snuck in. That's Sabina, by the way.
Yes, and I think as well, if you believe in climate change is happening and climate change is worsening weather patterns around the world, and then refuse to accept the migrants who need to who can't live where they're living because of climate change, then you're not. Then I don't know if you really actually care for humanity. Like, if you accept all the other stands, but you're like, yes, I understand that we over here release enough carbon to make your life impossible where you're living, but I will not give you a better option. That's Trumpism at its worst to some extent.
Yeah. And I think, that's really the big takeaway that I think everybody needs to get on their game. One of the things that really jumped out at me from that, I have a clip. I don't think we'll get to it just because there's so much here. I may end up playing it in the Bonus Show, but we recently got permission from the Young Turks, which, if you don't know who they are they're the largest online news show in the world, and people who are involved with the Young Turks have currently started the Justice Democrats, which is essentially the Bernie wing of the Democratic Party taking over the Democratic Party entirely, with a basically saying we're going to primary anyone who doesn't refuse for going forward to not take corporate money at all, zero. It's a developing story, but they're huge. They regularly beat CNN and Fox News for ratings. If you compare their views to eyeballs on TVs, they're not some sort of like basement, a bunch of people with five people listening. This is a massive independent news organization, the largest in the world. They had a clip where talking about the march and the experience, because many of their people went down to the women's march the next day. And so I have a little clip of them discussing that. We may play that in the bonus show. But the thing is, one of the signs that you'll see as the thing going around, yes, there was a lot of solidarity, but there was also, a number of photographs that I saw of African-American women with signs saying, I hope you all show up to the – all you nice white women, we're going to show up to the next Black Lives Matter protest. And that's a little bit of a bite there, and some people may object to that. I think they're all universally wrong, but it's because it's the most amazing point ever, which is that if you only show up for the thing that you feel concerns you, we've already lost. Right. So it doesn't matter. I mean, even if it's not something that terribly concerns you, if they're allies and they're joining you in your fight, you have to join them in theirs. This is literally the people. This is essentially, there's some scattering on both sides. There are some young people who are going, in the Trump direction. There's some older folks who are on our side. But at the end of the day, I mean, this really breaks down to essentially the entire new generation trying to look to the future and most of the old generation clinging desperately to the past. And that's really what this comes down to. And I'm sorry to say it. You pick a side. You've got to. There's no neutrality. There's no Sweden in this situation. You're either with us or you're with Trump. And I don't mean that. I don't say that happily. Mm-hmm. I say that as a realist. That's just the way it is.
Switzerland is the more neutral country usually.
I'm sorry. Yes, thank you, Stefan.
That's the most important fact check of the day.
Yes. Constantly self checking my hot air.
If you want to give us something to go off of as a way to keep in mind that April 29th, there is a massive march on Washington planned for jobs, justice, and climate. So keep that in mind if you want to start planning ahead and what resistance looks like. I think to some extent, you can take to the tweets, but it's more effective to take to the streets.
There you go.
that right now. Really happy about that.
Let's go to our first music break. We're going to come back and talk to Dr. Hugh Seeley, which is the Associate Professor of the Department of Public Health and Preventative Medicine at this School of Medicine in University of Granada, St. George's University in Granada, who is also one of two representatives for Latin America and the Caribbean at International Climate Change Agreements. So Dr. Hugh Seeley will be speaking to him after the break when we come back. But first, we're going to find out what our music break is going to be. All right, and we are back. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM, one of our wonderful and very appreciated community radio partners, international, as well as our podcast audience who is going to stick around, hopefully, and listen to our bonus show about news. But now we're going to talk to Dr. Hugh Seeley, who is the Associate Professor in Department of Public Health and Preventative Medicine, School of Medicine at St. George's University in Granada, and one of two representatives for Latin America and Caribbean dealing with the Clean Development Mechanism under the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. Welcome to the program, Dr. Hugh Seeley.
Thank you for having me on.
Thanks so much. Yes, yeah, so I was very interested to hear from you originally when we were contacted about doing this interview. To get this unique opportunity to hear from you about some of the inner workings and where we're sitting sort of from an international perspective. But of course, I don't know if you were listening to, if you had the ability to listen to the beginning of the program, but one of the things we mentioned, of course, was that just the word Trump appears to have sucked entirely all the oxygen out of the room for any other discussion. So I'm going to attempt to leave that for a moment and ask you my original interest, which was if you could just sort of outline for us, as far as from an international perspective and then also from the Latin American and Caribbean perspective, where are we right now as far as international cooperation on climate efforts?
Well, we had the Paris Agreement in November/December of 2015, and the Paris Agreement was historic. And this is the first time that we've gotten all the countries in the world to say yes, that they're going to make some sort of contributions towards mitigating climate change. We've put down targets of 2 degrees and 1.5 degrees, and the 1.5 degrees was a win for small islands because we find it extremely important that we try to limit warming to less than 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial times rather than 2 degrees. We also got commitments on finance that the developed countries would provide at least $100 billion per year to developing countries to help them to mitigate climate change and to adapt to climate change. What was also important for small islands is that we got loss and damage, a mechanism to help us to deal with those impacts that we cannot adapt to, and these will be things like sea level rise, ocean acidification, and extreme weather events. Just to correct your introduction, I am no longer on the CDM executive board as the Latin American and Caribbean representative. Mm. I represented the small island developing states on that board for the last 4 or 5 years, which are all the islands in the Caribbean, all the islands in the Pacific Ocean, and the Indian Ocean, and I now represent that constituency on what's called the Technical Executive Committee of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. So my main role is to negotiate on behalf of small islands.
Apologies for that error, Dr. Seeley. So one of the key issues, of course, when we're talking about international cooperation has been that many countries agree in theory on targets, as far as you mentioned, the 1.5 degree ideal and the sort of 2 degree soft or hard limit, depending on how you want to look at it. But the details, one of the sticking points often comes up with, well, who's going to pay for all of this stuff? And often the complaint of smaller nations is that the rich countries are not doing their part. How much, relative to all of the challenges currently, how much is that making up a component of a sticking point on further progress?
Oh, it is a big sticking point. At some point, the developed countries are going to have to put the money where their mouths are. They've been saying since Copenhagen in 2009 that significant climate finance is going to be provided to developing countries over and above the official development assistance or the ODA that was promised in the Monterey Consensus several years ago, which, as you probably know, is 0.7% of the gross national income of developed countries is supposed to be transferred to developing countries. and they have not met their promises there either. So it is going to get to a point where the developing countries are going to say, wait a second, we've made our commitments, we've signed on to the Paris Agreement, but we need to see the money for us to do two things. One, decarbonize our economies, but still achieve sustainable development and eliminate poverty. And two, adapt to the impacts of climate change that are now inevitable.
And speaking of impacts, Dr. Seely, that one of the things we've spoken about on this program repeatedly is that specifically dealing with small island states is that this isn't a future concern. This is a very current and ongoing concern. What is the sense of urgency when it comes to the current state as we are today in early 2017? And how high is the concern for the rate of solving these problems and getting action done in time to actually prevent permanent and irreparable damage to these states?
I don't know. Sometimes I feel like Chicken Little. I'm running around saying the sky has fallen, the sky has fallen. But the science is clearly saying that we are running out of carbon budget. We're running out of time, and that we cannot continue to emit the amounts of carbon that we put into the atmosphere. If we want to have any chance of staying below 2 degrees of warming, far less 1.5. Now, this is an existential issue for me because I live on a small island. This is not an economic issue that I can push into the future. The science is saying that the next decade is perhaps the most important decade facing mankind, and that we have to turn around our trajectories now, or else we're going to lock in catastrophic climate change. Now, how do you get your populations to recognize that this is an emergency when they don't see it outside, that they don't see it impacting on them personally? And that's the biggest problem that we have. There's a cognitive disconnect from this emergency, and I'm not sure how we bring that connection through to the ordinary person.
And as you were outlining and corrected me on the intro there, you've had a number of roles dealing with international conversations on this topic. I'm curious. I don't know to the degree to which you're able to comment, but I'm curious what impressions, if any, you have on the role of Canada as an outsider within these discussions. We hear a lot within the media here that there's a lot of heat put on Canada, especially under previous governments, but Trudeau has completely changed our image in our conversation. How does Canada feel as a part of this conversation from your perspective?
Well, I've got to make a confession. I was born in Edmonton, Alberta, so you're speaking to a fellow Canadian. and I was trained. I did my first degree at McGill in Montreal. So you are speaking to a Canadian who has been terribly frustrated in the past about the Canadian's position on climate change. But that did change with the change in administration that you've recently had, and I think that was one of the positive signs leading up to Paris. You had changes in administration both in Canada and in Australia that brought momentum to the Paris Agreement. Of course, the two big elephants in the room, excuse me, U.S. and China. I think it was imperative that they came to an agreement as well, or else we would not have gotten the Paris Agreement signed. The role that Canada plays now in this post-November 8th era that you don't want to talk about is going to be absolutely critical. Mm-hmm. You're the neighbor of the second largest emitter in the world, and still the most powerful country in the world, and the one that provides over 20% of the funding for all these negotiations to occur. So I'm absolutely hopeful that Canada will step up and will do what it has to do.
Mm. Well, you mentioned a couple of things there, including that have an angle on China. Just for our listeners' sort of perspective on this, the reason I'm interested in talking about China a little bit is twofold. One of which is, of course, if the U.S. Follows through, as we have no reason to believe that they won't now under Trump, who seems to be willing to follow through on all of his, even his most extreme propositions here, removing them from the international agreement, or at least not following it, even if regardless
regardless of what happens to the actual pieces of paper. And the two on that would be also him pulling out of TPP. And while there's a lot to not like about TPP, at least from our point of view, part of what it would have done would have been to sort of limit the economic expansion of China. So, Dr. Seely, I'm interested in knowing your perspective on, are we looking at a world where we're going to be increasingly dealing with, perhaps in a positive way, perhaps not in a positive way, but with China as the as one of the main actors in this arena, and less the Americans? Oh, Dr. Seely?
Looks like we may have lost him.
We may have lost him here, where techs are just looking really quickly. We'll give it another second while they play. Okay, hopefully we'll get him back on the line there. In the meantime, Stefan, what are your thoughts on that question I just asked as well?
China. Well, I think that's exactly what's going to happen. Like, I think that's definitely going to happen. I'm not even sure there's going to be a question about whether or not perhaps one of the most interesting things. I spent a bit of time trying to figure out why people would support the TP. That I wrote a piece about it last year, in which I dug into sort of all the different arguments for it, and perhaps the strongest argument that I had for why people would support it, given that, like, it was interesting because a lot of the economists had a very similar reaction of, like, yeah, you know, it's like fine. You know, the economists weren't saying like this was a massive change. They were very much sort of seeing it as a general, you know, expansion of free trade and a sort of a normal continuation of American policy to some extent. Mm. But the interesting piece about it was what it really did, and what really was clearly intended to do, was to reduce and remove the power that that China has in the region around it. That was part of its goal.
All right. I understand we may have Dr. Seely back. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, yes, we lost you there briefly. Thanks for coming back. I'll reiterate my question. I don't know where we cut you off, or where you got cut off. So I'll re-ask the question as well, which was in a world where we're very likely going to see the Americans pull out of their climate change agreements, whether or not that happens to the paper version, it seems very likely that we should believe Trump at this point that he's not going to follow through on their commitments. And with the failure with the additional loss of TPP, which some of us are less aggrieved about than others. This puts us that one of the facets of TPP is that it would have put some it would have slowed down the expansion of China as a sort of economic and global actor. With both of those things taken away, I'm interested in your thoughts on if we are going to increasingly be dealing, whether in a positive or a negative way, with China as one of the lead actors on this, and what does that mean for international cooperation.
I think that you are right that you're reading the TVs the way that we're reading them as well. I think there are still two scenarios that could potentially play out. One scenario is that the U.S. does remain engaged in the global negotiations. It does not leave the convention, nor does it leave the Paris Agreement, and it remains engaged. That, to me, is, of course, the best alternative. We would like the U.S. to continue to show leadership. If that does not happen and the U.S. decides to pull out of the agreement, then I think it is inevitable that another leading country will step into the vacuum that would have been created. As you know, power abhors a vacuum. Whether the European Union would be that block that could provide that leadership that would be in the absence of the U.S. And when I say leadership, I mean also providing the funds that allow for these negotiations to continue and to provide the funds to allow the research also to continue, or it would be Japan, or it would be China, and we have to look to see then what that means. As I said to you, the U.S. and China are the two biggest players in the world. China being the largest emitter as of now, and the U.S. being second. So if the U.S. pulls back, yes, I see China playing a larger role.
Yeah, and I mean, this is not only in the
negotiations. This is a larger role economically as well, because we still need a paradigm shift in our energy sectors. We still need a green revolution, and we will still be calling for that. And I hope that the momentum is there, and the economics is now there, because solar and wind are now becoming competitive and the prices are dropping, etc. So if that revolution continues, well, then I would expect that then if the U.S. pulls back, well, then China would capture more and more of the global market.
Hmm. And I mean, regardless of anything else, I think one thing is clear is that we're in for a lot of there's going to be a lot of geopolitical shifts, regardless of whether this is simply economic or if that there are, you know, perhaps, you know, one outset could simply be is that the international community, you know, there's a power shift as far as like alliances, as far as offsetting some of these bad actors that used to be sort of considered, you know, maybe not always super helpful, but at least on the same team. So we're in for, if nothing else, I think it can, the only thing we can say with certainty is that we're in for some big changes.
Absolutely. Can I just mention one major player that we're concerned about, and that is India. I think that India is going to play a pivotal role as well. How India provides energy to its energy poor. My understanding is that they have at least 200 million people who could define as not having access to modern energy services. How they provide those energy services is really going to be pivotal. And if the U.S. pulls back, will India see a loss of short-term competitive advantage and go to coal? Or would India continue the long haul and try to decarbonize its economy? China is already making the steps to decarbonize its economy. So I'm not worried that China is going to do what it says it's going to do. China will do it. And China will benefit from it from a public health standpoint because its cities are polluted. And it will also come up with the technologies that the world wants and it will capture a market. But what's the second most populous country in the world going to do? That to me is also key.
Mm. So I'm afraid that is unfortunately our time, Dr. Seely. I want to thank you very, very much for joining us and just ask you one very final, very quick question, which is, you know, our listeners are not international trade negotiators. They're probably very small percentage of them are involved in politics in any way. Is there anything at all that you can say to our average listener here as a way that they can support you in your work or support the international work, you know, aside from writing, you know, encouraging letters to Trudeau? Is there something an average person can do to support you and small island
states? I think the average person has to make climate change an issue with their politicians at the provincial level and at the federal level. This we have to mainstream this as a major political issue.
All right. Well, I absolutely agree. Yeah. Thank you so much. And of course, there was also an article I was sent that was authored by Dr. Seely called No Time to Waste as Islands Disappear. I will post that article as well with today's show post. Again, thank you very much for your time, Dr. Hugh Seely.
Thank you.
All right. So we're going to post that, as I said, on the website. You can look for more information about Dr. Seely's work and the article that was written by him that was posted in USA Today as well on the website at greenmajority.ca. We are now, however, going to go to our second and final music break. All right, we're coming back in here into the final home stretch with the Green Majority Radio program produced live right now on CIUT 89.5 FM, unless right now is on our recording and that it's not right now.
Right, exactly. But right now for us.
I think I mentioned last week that I just finished watching all three of the Back to the Future movies because they just got posted on Netflix and I'm getting really confused with my temporal language. anyhow, I do like movies about time. I think that's fun. Speaking of which, Time Machine? Oh, no, that was... who was it? Stephen Colbert, I think, was making a lot of jokes about the day before the inauguration about, so keep your eye out tomorrow for this and that and time travelers. Oh, man. If you laugh, you cry, folks.
Yeah, exactly.
That's why we like interrupting actual serious news with jokes
with
here.
With weird things, exactly.
Because otherwise the entire show would be me crying and Stefan consoling me.
Yeah, and the sobs just don't go over the airwaves nearly as well as you want them to.
Yeah, and I'm one of those really loud criers, too. It's really embarrassing. Yeah. Anyway.
As Barbara Roshina, the healthcare, the self-care practitioner that we had on earlier in the show, which actually was requested, a different listener of the show requested to have her back just because of how sad everyone is. I would say, though, Darren, is that all feelings are okay.
That's right.
So you can cry if you want to.
Well, no, I sent her a message because someone also yesterday also asked me to have her back on. And I sent her a message and she was like, anytime. And I said, so how about like maybe like once a month for 4 years? maybe more often. Okay. So I have a few news stories and I don't have a ton to say about any particular one. So I'm going to try and just rapid fire through them because I actually want to talk a little bit about trade a little bit as a preview for an upcoming show. So I'm going to rapid fire through some stuff and then I'm basically going to just like set up a future show that I've been talking about forever, but I've actually started for real planning now. So quickly, to follow up, we've had more reporting coming out, just sort of ongoing on the issue of Justin Trudeau's town halls going around specifically in Alberta, where there's been, I think, surprising no one, some very impassioned confrontations. The thing that actually surprised me, of course, was not in any way that some loud protesters came and tried to shout out Dowling during his conversation. That doesn't surprise me at all. What surprised me a little bit was actually in a good way, which was you know, just because my standards are low with this sort of thing right now. And not just because they were people from Alberta, but specifically, you know, oil sand supporters tend to come out to this sort of thing. Was that one thing Trudeau's did was stuck up his hand and said, you know, who actually believes in climate change? And I think somewhat to his surprise, but at least to some people's, the vast majority of the people put their hands up. Hmm. And so that meant that at the very least with that, I mean, there was only about 2,000 people there, and they were very impassioned, and many of them were not in favor of Trudeau. Let's not conflate those two things. At least to the people even in the thick of it, aka the people who are concerned that their futures are at stake here on this conversation, at least even a majority of them, apparently, at least the people impassioned enough to come out to this event or these events, are at least in agreement that this is a real problem. And I'm sorry to say that feels like progress, because at least we're all on the same page as far as the conversation being a real conversation. One other thing, and of course I gave Trudeau some flack last week, saying, you know, why would you do this? It seemed like a one-off comment. It seems like he is now sticking to this, and there was this really awkward initial, like, no, I misspoke. Okay, so then we don't have to get off fossil fuels? What do you mean by misspoke? So apparently, that was just their way to deflect the initial blow-up, but he does appear to be sticking with that message that, although I don't agree with the message, I will at least give him points for being consistent, that yes, this is, you know, this feels so sad to say this, but he has enough courage to now consistently say that, yeah, we have to plan for getting off oil. He's simply deflecting the anger by saying this is at some vastly future date. But again, sadly, this is progress that our political, not just that Trudeau would say, because of course Trudeau would say that, but that he at least has enough of a backbone, to say it to people whose jobs are at risk. Now, of course, I want to just quickly reiterate my criticism from last week, which is that if you're going to say that, and you should, you better come up with a plan about either you're playing patty cakes and then this is so far off in the future that you're like, yeah, I'm not going to do anything about it, but I'm going to admit it's a real problem, and then some future government will do something about it. If that's what you're saying, then that's just scummy. If that's not what you're saying, and I'm going to choose to give him the benefit of the doubt, then I strongly encourage you, Mr. Trudeau, to actually come up with a plan about how to do that. Because let me, I hate to break it to you, but simply putting a cap on carbon emissions that allows for, was it doubling or tripling? Doubling to tripling of current thing, that itself is not a plan to get off oil. That's a plan to prevent more than a doubling or tripling of our expansion of oil. That's not a plan to get off oil. I would strongly encourage you, if you want to be able to stave off these. I mean, these are small attacks coming from voters at events. If you want to weather an election, you're going to have to come up with a plan to back those statements up, because otherwise they're going to string you up with those comments. Hmm. And of course, I'm talking about politically here. Let's not get out of hand. But quite seriously, they're going to take those comments and they're going to repeat them and repeat them and repeat them and repeat them and repeat them, and they're going to beat you over the head with them. You're going to have to come up with a plan. So one of the things we're going to talk about on a future show is Stefan and I have been talking about casually for a while. And as soon as he's done with a current project that's taking him all of his time, mm-hmm. We'll start actually rolling this out. But we're going to actually create a fictitious platform. The platform would be real. The party it's for will be fake. But a number of ideas of policies that we think actually does what Trudeau is now saying that he has to be done, but doesn't appear to actually be creating any plans for. We're going to make a number of suggestions. We're going to talk about that on air. We're going to ask people to send us some of their ideas, and then at some point
point after that show where we sort of debate those ideas and we take a break off news and we just talk about, you know, policy, public policy that we would like to see. We will be posting this real platform for our fake political party on the website and say, please steal these ideas. That's the goal going forward. So for now, we'll leave that alone. Notley, of course, welcoming Trump's survival of Keystone XL. Nobody's super surprised about that. I think I've already said all I want to say about that, other than the fact about how it relates to one other criticism I'd like to make of Trudeau as well, which is that, he was very, they're going to be meeting at some point, apparently in the next 30 days, Trump and Trudeau, to talk about the new NAFTA deal. Of course, Keystone XL and all these things will be discussed. And I just want to ask people how they feel about that. I've recently been watching a new show that I like very much called Colony, which is about aliens basically occupying Earth. And it's a sort of a futuristic look about at essentially what it's like to live under a literal fascist dictatorship. And, you know, and one of the things that happens in the show all the time, then you'll see where I'm going. I'm not just obsessed with TV this week. is that the whole point of the show is that, you know, essentially there is no point to resistance. These aliens have, you know, technology so far beyond that it's literally like people are just like, there's no path to resistance. And the entire show is about essentially is these terrorists essentially from the point of view and the collaborators. And I just kept getting chills running down my spine because of all these conversations about, hey, well, you know, you can either get punished or you can benefit, but there's no opposition. And so it's, do you want a reward? And then I started reading some news about, Trudeau being really excited about basically brushing aside. I mean, sure, he made a couple of comments, but essentially his whole thing is, you know, has been to like, well, this could work out really well for us. And I just felt sick. I just felt sick because it feels to me he'll have an opportunity to prove me wrong. But I just feel like it's going to be like, we're going to keep our mouth shut on all this human rights abuses and all these, you know, this super uber racist fascist policies because we might get a little bit of money out of like playing nice with this guy. I just want to ask our listeners, how does that make you feel? Even if you sort of agree with them on the pipeline issues, doesn't that just whole tone of like, here's our new best new buddy because we might make some money out of this, doesn't it make you feel a little bit sick to your stomach? Just a little?
Yeah, I think Trudeau is in a fascinatingly difficult position because like if you want to think about how you deal – like how you deal with a bully, because in reality, America has so much power over Canada. That, you know, if Trudeau came out and decided to be the voice of the resistance, Trump almost out of hand could crush the Canadian economy, and it wouldn't even have to, you know, it would affect America as well, obviously. But there's obviously a power dynamic that Trudeau is dealing with that has to be understood. And I think what's problematic, I think, is that the way you deal with a bully is you let them think they're winning while you do other stuff, right? Like that's usually the strongest resistance to this kind of thing is that like if you have someone you have to deal with, you could either like if you let them think that they're it's everything's fine, but I'm actually going to oppose you or I'm going to do all the other stuff because like you're not going to figure it's how this works. But at the same time, because of how awful he's being, it puts Trudeau in a place where you're right. If he is almost by refusal to staying silent, it's a tacit complicity within the rhetoric and everything else that's going on. And so I think Trudeau has to figure out where he stands. And I think there's actually one way he can do something right now, which will simultaneously not necessarily which can prove his that he stands up for what he believes in without necessarily reacting to negative Trump, which is that he can actually allow asylum seekers in the United States to move to switch asylum into Canada instead. And that's an old law that we had that where you have to technically come directly from the place you're scheming to get status as a refugee. But he can actually change that law. That's the thing Trudeau can do right now, which is to change the law to allow people who are currently seeking asylum in the States who are going to be rejected under Trump, instead of forcing them to go back to where they are fleeing from, that Canada can accept them. And I think if you were going to take a stance where you want to still be able to say you stand up for the correct values and you stand up for, you know, the values that we all would like to think of as Canadian values of acceptance said inclusivity. That's a way of doing it without just sort of, you know, calling Trump a small-handed, you know, orange buffoon, which will only sort of set off a much different reaction, right?
And sure, and of course, and I know you're saying that, not thinking that that's what I'm proposing, but just
he obviously come out in many other ways and oppose the way he's saying things. I'm just saying that it's a very dangerous position for Trudeau to be in many different ways.
Right.
And I think I don't know exactly what he should be doing, but this is one thing he can do right now that can at least help.
Right. And I mean, who's to say what, you know, back channel conversations have already happened. What I would like to see, and maybe I'm being naive, fair enough. But what I would like to see is, I mean, when a number of, you know, deals have happened, so say, you know, a deal with China, people will go, well, this is really good for Canadian economy, but and people go, oh, well, China is such a human rights abuser and blah, 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 you know, we shouldn't be blah, 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 blah. I have two points about that. One, A, if things continue the way they are, there's a point at which the U.S. becomes a worse global actor than the Chinese do. Many of our pipelines, you know, the pipelines that they're building to go to water as opposed to Keystone XL, which goes through the U.S., is to go to Asian markets. There is a opportunity there, and of course, this is extremely complicated. We're talking about extremely deep and well-connected ties. This would happen over a long period of time. But where our main economic partner shifts to Asia as opposed to the U.S. If things get bad, I'm just saying it's on the table. Nobody panic. I'm not a sleeper cell for the Chinese government. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying we have to deal with reality as it unfolds. That's one thing. And I hope they're at least keeping, at least at a planning, secretive planning point of view, their options open, because we don't know how bad it's going to get. And we don't want to make sure that we as much as we want to protect ourselves, it's not protecting ourselves if we, super glue ourselves to a sinking ship. The other thing as well is that what I would like to see is at least a minor, like just the tiniest amount of backbone, just a wee little bit of backbone where it goes, hey, you know, I've spoken to American counterparts and here, this is not my opinion. I'm saying this is what I could see Trudeau saying that I think is realistic, which is, you know, we've spoken to American counterparts. We think that Keystone XL is going to be really good for our economy. We're looking forward to creating a great relationship with this. I have spoken to my contacts in the U.S. government and expressed to them our concern about some of their human rights decisions and about their treatment of whatever. Just say that, hey, I just want to be on record saying we do not agree with this part of this policy. That's, I think, is an incredibly low bar, and Trudeau has yet to meet that bar. That's all I'm saying. So I think we have about 3 minutes left. I want to just really quickly mention something. So we have there's another article there as well that we could get into that's about fracking. What I will just let people know instead then of getting into that with our last minutes, of course, that we're going to be talking about this article in the bonus show, which you can only find on the podcast at greenmajority.ca or through our own podcast that's going through iTunes called Dear Media, the Trump White House has total contempt for you, time to react accordingly, that was posted by the Washington Post. I will also take the last minute to let people know that every week, or remind them rather, because I do usually say this, but I want to emphasize this week, of course, as well, that we do quite a bit of news surfing, and we get a lot more news articles than we actually end up talking about on the show. And I don't post all of them, but if there's something that I really think is worth a read and we don't get to it on the show, I always post that as well. So I want to call people's attention to a couple of articles. I really encourage them to take some time to read. One of them is Naomi Klein wrote, I think this is for Vox, but it's called Ready for the First Shocks of Trump's Disaster Capitalism. That is an excellent read. I think you should make time to read that article as well. There's also a bunch of reports by The Guardian, which I think is worth a look. Outgoing EPA chief fears Trump administration will halt climate action. Those are worth a read as well. And a number of other ones having to do with both Trumpian and non-Trumpian stories. So just definitely, I would say, if there's my one definitely read, aside from the stuff we're going to talk about on the show, that would definitely be that Disaster Capitalism piece by Naomi Klein. But see the website for more as well. That is, as we just said, though, all the time we have for this week's show. Thank you for listening to The Green Majority. Sabina is here. She only jumped in once really quickly, but she'll join us for the bonus show as well. Stefan will stick around as well. So listen to the podcast for the extended version and some more commentary on the news. Other than that, have a good green week, folks. Thanks for listening, and take care.